Hi, what's up, YouTube? We're on TikTok, we're on Spotify, wherever you are, on Apple Podcasts or whatever. We're back. It's 2023. It's Wednesday. It's Thursday night. It's Thursday night. I'm a little punchy. I just drove in from Utah. I just got back literally like an hour and a half ago. I loaded all the shit that I traveled to Utah with and then some out of my car into my apartment. And I was rip-roaring to go. I was talking. When I drive from Utah to LA or vice versa, I just talk to people. I talk for hours. Sarah Smart's here on TikTok saying, hello. Hi, Sarah. Been a while since I've seen you. How you doing? I hope you're having a great start to your 2023. But I chat with people and I got full up. I got filled up. There was good stuff in those conversations today. I had some long conversations with people that I really care about. And it was great. It was great. And I felt really full. And I got out of the car and I was like, I'm ready to blab, dude. I'm ready to talk for an hour and a half. So that's what we're going to do. It's People Pleaser from a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. Welcome to it. If this is your first time, hi. We're having a good time. We've been here for a while. It's been about 3 years now. And you're welcome to go back through the catalog and listen if you like what you're hearing. And you're also welcome to never listen to another episode again if you hate it. Both of those options are fine. We're going to jump right into the show. We got so much show today. So we're going to jump right into some ba-bow, bow, the Bad Take Brigade to start off 2023. A little Bad Take Brigade. I just found out about this person today. I had no idea who this person was. She came across my Twitter feed and I was like, who dis? Looked her up. Megan Murphy is a podcast host of a podcast called The Same Drugs. I don't know much about this person. I tried to do a little background info to try to get a vibe of what her politics are. Seems a little turfy, to be honest. There's a lot of stuff where she's like, well, what's happening to women? With everyone focusing on trans people, what's happening to the designation of women? Seems a little turfy. Gonna say, seems a little turfy. That's all I'm going to say, okay? I don't know. I'd have to do more investigating to actually put the label on there with some confidence, but just some of the stuff that I read just in passing. I'm not really going to get into that. That's tangential territory. That's not really the point. But she wrote this thread, and she did this podcast episode about why she thinks that porn is evil and should be banned. Why we should just get rid of porn, make it illegal. Porn is awful. We all agree. It causes so many societal problems. It's terrible. We should just ban it. I'm just going to go ahead and read the thread that came across my Twitter thread from Megan Murphy. What she said is, what I've learned from this conversation is that men who like/defend porn seem not to view the women/girls on the other side of the screen as human. This sounds cliched, but literally so many of the arguments are, why not ban alcohol then? I think this argument is not being made in good faith. But for those who truly believe this is a fair comparison, I mean, isn't the obvious difference that alcohol is a product and porn is people? I'm just going to stop really quickly and just say, that it's like you're comparing alcohol to like a thing to a person. You're dehumanizing the women who participate in this industry. By the way, throughout this thread and throughout her entire conversation, she has nothing to say about men or non-binary people who work in the porn industry. It's all focused on the women who are preyed upon and who are the victims of this industry, which none of my clapback is to say that there are not victims in this industry and that there are not people being taken advantage of and not people being exploited. That is not what I'm saying at all, but it is just a thing where she seems very focused on like the fact that like porn is just this industry that is victimizing and abusing women and that no one cares about it. And anyway, but right here where she's saying the people who are defending it, compare them to alcohol, which is a product. Well, I think the more apt comparison and the more nuanced comparison there would probably be that the manufacture and distribution of alcohol is a job, and the manufacture and distribution of adult film is a job. That the one-to-one comparison being made there is both things are industries full of people who are employed by that industries, people who have a job, who are gainfully employed by that industry. That is the comparison. It's not saying that in that analogy that alcohol is the same as women, it's saying that the alcohol industry that is very problematic and has many issues and has caused a lot of problems in society, we don't say, let's ban that industry and let's get rid of that. The same way that she's saying, because this industry has problems with exploitation and abuse, we should ban this industry. So I think that's actually the comparison that's being made. I'll continue reading her thread. It's troubling that men who like/consume porn, again, the focus is on men being bad and women being victims of that. She doesn't seem to acknowledge that, like, women consume porn and non-binary people consume porn. Again, nowhere in this do I want to make it sound like I'm not aware that men are terrifying sex monsters with control issues who like to work out their feeling of a lack of control over their own lives through sexual violence. Like, I am aware of how terrible men are and the fact that people have real, actual trauma caused by men, real trauma caused by men surrounding sex. So I don't want it to sound like I'm not aware of where her position comes from, but everything in her take when it comes to porn seems to be surrounding the fact that, like, only men consume it, and that the only men who consume it and defend it only do so because they don't view the women in the industry as people, that they're dehumanizing them. And I'm not saying that men like that don't exist. Of course they do. Of course there are men consuming porn who don't view the women in that industry as people worthy of respect. Those men exist everywhere. They exist everywhere, and they enact that shitty toxicity in any industry, anywhere. You can find them all over the world. So I understand where her concern is rooted, and I think that it's rooted in a valid place. But she says, it's troubling that men who like/consume porn don't think about what might be happening to the women on the other side of their screen. How is this impacting her physically, mentally, emotionally? When I talk about banning porn, I think of it in the same way I do prostitution. Fundamentally, it is not ethical to buy or sell or to buy or sell sex or to buy or sell access to other people's bodies. This is kind of the crux of where I think that her position is rooted in, is like, whether she's aware of it or not, it's this sex negative idea that sex fundamentally is linked with immorality and a lack of ethics. And I think what she thinks she's making here is a point about bodily autonomy and consent, that fundamentally you should not sell access to another person's body. That should be theirs to control. And I think what she's missing here is that healthy, informed consent can and does exist in sex work. Period. End of sentence. That she's really depriving a lot of the women in the adult industry of their autonomy and their ability to self-determine what they want to do with their body. What's interesting is she thinks she's making an argument about how you should not sell access to another person's body. That should be theirs. What she's actually doing is making an argument where the government should deprive people who work in sex work industries of the ability to self-determine what they want to do with their body. This is one of the oldest industries in the world. People have always been deciding that they are okay with consenting to selling access to their body for money, because money exists. That's a thing that we created, that we made up. And since it does, people went, well, this is a thing that people want, that I have, that I can sell if I choose to. And Megan is saying, no, we should ban the ability to sell that if we choose to. We should make it illegal for people to sell that. And she's trying to make the argument from a place of protecting bodily autonomy and the sanctity of bodily autonomy and the idea that no one should be able to buy access to another person's body, that fundamentally that is immoral and unethical. And I think that she's actually advocating for less bodily autonomy and less bodily freedom. Now, I want to address the whole part of her argument where she says that the men who defend and consume porn, here I am sitting right here, do so because they're not concerned about what's happening to the women on the other side of the screen. They dehumanize them. They don't see them as people worthy of respect. Again, I've already addressed the fact that problematic men exist. Of course, men fucking suck. Like, we can all be on the same page about that. And there are many reasons why that exists. And where that comes from. I think a good argument could be made that sex negativity and sexual repression contributes more to sexual violence than sex positivity and a healthy outlook on sex. And I think our society, by and large, has more sex negativity than sex positivity in it and in its structure. And a lot of that comes from religion. So like, it's like, where does Megan's idea that sex is fundamentally linked with immorality come from? Where is it really rooted in? And Megan is like a self-professed feminist. So this is a person who at one point thought of herself as being very progressive. She's done articles about how she left the left, and she's one of those people who like the left got too radical or whatever. And I think it's probably because of some of the turfy stuff that she is taken in by, but whatever. She's not a person who probably thinks of herself as getting her sense of morality from religion. But where does this idea that sex is inherently problematic or immoral come from? And it could be, I don't want to speculate on where it comes from for her. I don't know her background. I don't know what her upbringing is. It could be from religion. She could have a religious upbringing. It could be from from trauma. Both of those things are valid. Both of those things are things that she did not choose, that she was born into a religion that she did not choose and experienced trauma and bad programming around sex from that, or was just a victim of abuse herself. And I'm not speculating on that, and I'm not going to say what it was or where it comes from, but I am saying that whatever the reason, those are valid reasons. Those are real things that should be respected and should be dealt with a certain severity and reverence, and that's real. But where does societal sex negativity come? How does religion begin to, and it's not just Christianity, it's like most of the world's largest and most powerful religions are quite sex negative and push the narrative that like sex essentially is bad outside of a certain religious framework where it suddenly becomes good. And usually that's like marriage in that religion. If you get married in that church to a person, then it's okay. In any other context, it's like one of the worst things that you can do. Where does that come from? Well, I think that fundamentally, one of the oldest tricks for powerful institutions that wish to control people en masse has been to control their access to their fundamental needs. So structure, like the creation of money, the creation of needing to have money to pay for things like food and shelter and things that people just need fundamentally to live, creating a framework in society where you are dependent on a power structure that traditionally has been dictated over by a religious body to get your fundamental needs. One of the harder things for these institutions to control access to was sex, though. They, unlike with like food and shelter, where you're like, I have to purchase land and I have to purchase the materials to build my home with and I have to purchase the food to feed, like people were still like, I can go up to another person and have a consensual interaction with them and decide to consensually with them have sex, and no one can tell me I can't. Well, here comes the power structure creating a mythos around sex that somehow the divine designer of the universe has a built-in morality clause around that, where that is a really evil thing to do unless it's in marriage. And it's got to be a guy and a girl. Can't be two guys, can't be two girls, can't be no non-binary stuff going on. That didn't even exist back then. They weren't even talking about that. It's just got to be a daddy and a mommy getting married at the church, and then they can bone all they want, and it's fine. But if it's not that, it's bad. And this was a way to control that extra need that people have and, you know, foster or manufacture subservience, to get people's obedience, to get people to fall in line. You control their access to their fundamental needs. So that's, I think, the root of a lot of societal sex negativity. And I think a lot of sexual violence is born out of that sex negativity. I think that people, fundamentally, men, women, non-binary people, people across the gender spectrum, are stripped of their autonomy and stripped of their control over their lives. And men have been given, through a system that they designed at some point, you know, a sense of dominion over women. And so that's like this one little area where they have a morsel of control and they act out that desire for control in that one area where they feel powerful, where they feel control. And so it's a control thing. It's a feeling of ownership, but all of that is born out of this sex negative framework that we are operating with in society. It doesn't help anyone. It's bad for everyone. Just like the patriarchy doesn't help anyone and is bad for everyone. So anyway, that's my argument about, you know, where her whole take might be coming from and might be rooted in. But this idea that she has, that the people who defend it don't care about the well-being of the performers on screen, that they don't care about the well-being of the performers on screen. I'm just speaking anecdotally here, and I'm just speaking for myself, just speaking from my personal experience. My defense of this industry is not rooted in the fact that I just like it and I don't care about what happens to the people on screen. It's rooted in the fact that I have personal friends who work in this industry across the gender spectrum. I have female friends. I have trans friends, trans men, trans women. I have non-binary friends. I have male friends who work in the sex industry, who work in the adult industry. I know these people personally, and I have an insight a bit into how they're doing and what their sense of well-being is. So I'm just going to speak anecdotally here for a little bit. I made most of my friends in this industry in the last couple years. It was a surprise to me. It just sort of happened. They just flowed into my experience. And I'm going to tell you, my whole life, I had this idea that if I were to ever hang out with a bunch of porn stars, it would be wild. I have this idea based on the art that they create and the media that they put out into the world that every day hanging out at a porn star's house is a raging party with crazy drugs, that these are just crazy, wild, unhinged people, 24/7 orgies, everyone's naked all the time. And you know, folks, I gotta tell ya, it ain't like that. Like, I was weirdly surprised to find out that these people, who I think are lovely people, who I'm so happy to have made friends with, are rather ordinary and just sort of normal folks, turns out they're just people with a job. Just people with a job they're good at, a job that they get paid well for, a job that they're proud of, even though a lot of people in society work really, really hard to make them ashamed for having that job. And that's it. And when I hang out with them, we're not just like doing a bunch of debaucherous stuff. In fact, many of them are like some of the most spiritually enlightened people I've ever met. They're like constantly meditating and going to like, you know, like drum circles and getting sound baths done and doing like spiritual healing retreats and things like that. Like, they're just people. They're just people with a job. Okay. Megan goes on to say in some of her responses, so that's my big thing, is I'm like, I don't not care about these people. I know these people. And I know that a lot of them are okay. They're fine. They know what they do. They've made the choice as autonomous adults to do what they do. They're proud of what they do. They're good at what they do. And they feel like they provide an age-old service to people. And they're comfortable with what they do. And they're secure in what they do. Megan goes on to say, and I think this is really, really the crux of her issue, is that she might be open to, that there might be some nuance that she might be leaving out. I mean, honestly, I read her article and everything, and it reads like someone who didn't bother actually interviewing someone who works in the industry. And if she did interview anyone who worked in the industry, she probably interviewed people who have left the industry because they had a bad experience. And I just have to say that, first of all, having a bad experience in that industry is valid. Someone saying, hey, I was in that industry and I was exploited, I was taken advantage of, I was abused, is valid and is real. But you could do the same thing with pretty much any industry in the world. You could find someone to interview who has left that industry, who had a bad experience, that is a valid bad experience. Someone who was working at McDonald's and their manager was abusive to them and took advantage of them and exploited them, and that person went, I had a really bad experience there. That's valid and that's real. It doesn't mean that the entire industry needs to be made illegal. It doesn't mean that we need to ban McDonald's or ban fast food or make illegal restaurants, you know? But what she fundamentally has a problem with is exploitation and abuse. She goes on to say that in response to a commenter. She goes, "I'm mostly concerned with exploitation and abuse." And on that, pardon me, had a little burp. On that, I have no problem agreeing with her. Full stop, we absolutely agree. We do not want people to be exploited or abused in any industry or anywhere. So does exploitation exist in the adult film industry? Does addiction exist? Does violence exist? Does abuse exist? Of course it does. Absolutely. And those things all exist in every other industry in the world. Now, a person could say, well, but they exist more in the adult industry. First of all, how do you know that? Are you going it? Do you work in that industry? Have you seen it firsthand? Or are you just assuming because of your moral framework informed by the societal framework created by religion designed to control people? Like, how do you know that? Do you actually know that? And second of all, no, I personally don't think that it does exist more in that industry. As an actor who spent his entire life trying to make it in theater and film, I can tell you firsthand that hungry actors, hungry artists, hungry scenic designers, and screenwriters and playwrights and directors are notoriously easy to exploit. People who are hungry to get into the entertainment industry are just notoriously easy to take advantage of. And almost every job that I've ever done as an actor in my entire life has involved me being taken advantage of in one way or another because I was so desperate to just have a job and to work and to have the exposure and to be seen. Almost always. And everyone who works in this industry can attest to that. Everyone who's ever worked on a crew, who's ever done PA, like, and who's ever worked 14-hour days, 6 days a week on a movie, getting paid like $200 a day and a meal, and you're just not seeing your family and you're just working your ass off because you're trying to pay your dues so that one day you can get your movie made, maybe, is well aware that the entertainment industry, the music industry, photography are all massively exploitative industries that have no problem exploiting their talent and the people who work for them. It does not exist more in the adult industry. If anything, my friends who work in sex work, who work as dancers at strip clubs, who work as performers in porn, have more autonomy than most people I know in theater and film. They have the ability to direct and write and produce their own material and their own media. They start their own production companies that are massively successful. Like, they get to run the show. A lot of times in the porn industry has way, way, way more, by orders of magnitude, more female directors and producers than Hollywood does. I promise you. I promise you. Women who have their entire own line of, like, merchandise and their own website and their own production company where they're the producer and the director and the artistic director and the casting director, and they're, like, running the show. And that stuff just, like, doesn't exist in Hollywood or in the music industry, which is another notoriously exploitative industry. So do bad things exist in porn? And I want to make it really clear, I am not saying that the porn industry is perfect or above reproach. Do bad things exist? I talked earlier about how, like, informed, healthy consent exists in sex work. Does coercion exist, though? Are there people working in sex work who would rather not be working there, who feel like they have no other options and they're backed into a corner financially and it's their only option? Of course. Of course that exists. And again, that exists everywhere. There are people in every single industry in the world who feel backed into a corner financially, who feel like, I wish I could do something else, and this feels like the only thing that I can do now because I've been doing it for so long and I don't have any connections anywhere else and I can't get out. There are people who are making good money. There are people working for Elon Musk right now. There are people who are, like, on his staff, on his personal staff. There are people who are, like, Elon Musk's assistant who have... There was a person whose job it was to go to the Home Depot and buy a sink or like Lowe's or something and buy a sink for Elon Musk to carry into Twitter on his first day. There are people that have to do all kinds of stupid shit for a rich boss that they're like, I don't even know how I feel about this. I don't know if I align with this ethically. I don't know if I align with this morally, but the guy pays me well, and what the hell else am I gonna do? Coercion, manipulation, exploitation, abuse. These things are bad and they exist in every industry. We can criticize these things and be aware of these things and try to fix these things without demanding that the entire industry gets banned or made illegal or disbanded or abolished. Now, before I move on to topic number two for the podcast, there's one more thing I got to address because what I just said, I know that there's someone out there on YouTube or on Spotify or maybe even on TikTok who's going to hear what I just said and go, so why abolish police then? And this, I mean, I got to say, this feels like a tangent. This feels like tangential territory that doesn't have anything to do with the topic because it is, and it doesn't have anything to do with the topic, but I want to just quickly address it. The difference between those two things, because I am an abolitionist and I am like fuck police and ACAB all the way. And people, if they heard what I just said and where I said it's totally possible to see problematic aspects of an industry without wanting to throw out the entire industry. The difference between the police, between law enforcement in the United States and the adult industry or any other industry with problematic aspects is if workers in the adult industry were a blood in, blood out cult-like gang that all backed each other up no matter what, that were like, once you're in this industry, it doesn't matter what anyone does. It doesn't matter if that producer over there totally exploits that performer. We all get each other's backs no matter what. If that's how it functioned in that industry, then maybe I'd be on Megan Murphy's team and I'd be saying, yeah, let's get rid of that industry. It's rotten. But that's not how that industry functions. There are so many people, my friends, good people in that industry who are doing everything they can to foster an environment where everyone on set feels seen, heard, listened to, important, respected, taken care of, where everyone feels like they're having fun and like they can enjoy their work environment. There are people in that industry who are trying to foster a healthy work environment and who are openly critical of those who are enacting the abuse and the exploitation. And that is not how it works in American law enforcement. Every time I talk about how the police is just a rotten, broken institution, people go, ah, don't generalize like that. And the problem is, all I need is for all these good cops out there in the world, and I'm doing that with quotes for anyone just listening to the show, all these good cops to be vocal and to be active about taking down the bad ones. So every time I see a video of a police officer definitely breaking the law and definitely stepping outside the confines of their power allotment and definitely taking advantage and manipulating the law in their favor, every time I see a video of a police officer murdering someone in cold blood on camera and all the other good cops in the world don't do everything they can to hold that person accountable and get that person in jail, that's one more tick on cops are broken. It's broken. It's a broken industry. It's a broken system, and it needs to go. Because what I need to see is the good ones. I need to see the good ones saying, we're going, because they actually are endowed with the power to go and hold the bad ones accountable. And not only do they not hold them accountable, but they actively support and defend them. So if that's what I was seeing with the adult industry, if I was seeing all of the quote unquote like good adult performers going to bat for all of the problematic ones, then I'd say, yeah, this whole industry is rotten. But that's not how it works. And that's not how it works in most industries. In most industries, the good people in that industry are trying to do what they can to make their industry a healthy, safe place to work and trying to hold the bad people accountable. And I also just want to say another tangent, another little tangential territory. This kind of blood in, blood out gang cult mentality that we see with police is just very typical of like people on the right and right wing ideology in general. These are just people who play team ball, who just, I don't care what someone on my team does, they're on my team. Herschel Walker gets to have abortions because he's on my team. And I don't care that that makes me a hypocrite. Herschel Walker's on my team. And they assume the rest of us play this way, too. You see people on Twitter being like, oh, so okay, liberals, okay, Democrats, do we want to see Joe Biden's tax returns? And it's like, hey, guy, first of all, we did. We have seen them. They are public. And second of all, yeah, we do. If Joe Biden is committing tax fraud, we want to know about it. Because we're not in a weird cult where we're trying to actively cover up crimes for our person. We're not playing team ball to a fault where we're just totally okay with anything that anyone on our team does because the end goal is just to beat the other team. And that's what we see. That's what we see all too often with people defending the police and the police defending each other and just people on the right in general, is it doesn't matter what someone on their team does. It doesn't matter how much that behavior violates their own personal code of ethics or morals. That person's on their team. As far as they're concerned in their ideology, the cops are on their team. It's people who support the cops versus people who support Black Lives Matter. And those are the teams. And it doesn't matter if a person who supports the cops sees a video of a police officer behaving in an objectively reprehensible way. They're on team cop, and they're going to find a way to defend and support that behavior. Versus over here on the left, where I can say, no, I support my friends in the adult film industry, and I support them and their job. And sex work is work. And that is valid work that they do. And I support their right to be autonomous over their body and make choices about what they do for their work. And I support that. And at the same time, I can also say, and I stand against exploitation and abuse and coercion and manipulation in that industry and in all industries. End of Bad Take Brigade. Moving on, okay? We did it. We did it. How's everybody doing? Do we need a breather? Do we need a breather? Let's do a little buffer. MRAD350 on TikTok said, you know how fast white people turn on cops when they're the ones targeted? Neck break speed. I mean, yeah, we saw that with January 6th, right? Blue Lives Matter, support the blue, except for if they're trying to prevent you from getting into the Capitol to kill Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi. In that case, you can beat a cop to death with an American flagpole. That's fine. As long as they're working for us and they're brutalizing communities of color, back the blue. But if they're coming after us, nah. Let's move on to something more light and nice and beautiful, shall we? I've got a really nice thing for you here. I've got a really nice thought, okay? I think that first thing was a nice thought too, through a certain lens. And I hope it was eye-opening to anyone who does have like icky feelings about adult work or sex work. Sex work is work. It's one of the oldest industries in the world. It's valid work. And there are problematic aspects of it. There are problematic aspects of every job. And the people who are doing it right don't deserve to be thought of as immoral or unethical people when they're doing everything they can to do it in an ethical and moral way. I think that's a nice thought. But this is a good one. This is something that just happened in my drive on the way back here. This sort of realization, and it's really something I've been working through for the last 4.5, 5 years, to be honest. It's the start of the new year. This is the first episode of 2023. I want to talk a little bit about thoughts that I've had on how growth happens in our personal, spiritual, professional lives, our romantic lives, like how to grow. How do we grow? What is necessary for growth? And I'm going to do it through the framework of the Serenity Prayer. And I want to make a caveat. I want to be really clear. This episode is not an infomercial for Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? That's not what this is. That's not what I'm talking about. But I am going to talk about this prayer. It's this mantra, if you will, whatever word, this slogan, this saying, whatever word sits right with you, you've heard it. God, you can get rid of that word if you want. Don't need it. Whatever word works for you. Universe, Allah, Buddha, higher self, higher power, whatever word works for you. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. You know this saying, you've heard it, you've seen it, it was on like your grandma's wall on a plaque when you were growing up. Like you know this prayer. We're just going to use this as the framework to talk about how this really does kind of encapsulate kind of everything you need to do in order to grow as a person in this world, okay? So first of all, we're going to start with, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. So what are the things you cannot change? Let's define that. Let's define that. Put simply, the things you cannot change are everything and everyone else. It's just everything. Shannon Screams on TikTok just said, ick, not that shit. We know Dreamscape Jesus. Scary. Yeah, just hang with me. I thought you said not that shirt first. I was reading your comment and I thought you were criticizing my shirt. I'm wearing an excellent shirt right now. For those people who are just listening to the audio version, you're missing out. You're seeing only part of it on YouTube. I'm going to hold it up for YouTube. You see that, YouTube? See that? And on TikTok, they're getting a real good view. It's just a great shirt. But hang with me. Hang with me here. If the God stuff makes you feel icky, if prayer makes you feel icky, that's not necessarily what we're talking about. I'm not selling you on the idea of a God or any specific God or on the idea that you need to pray or anything like that. That's not what we're talking about. We're using this saying as a framework to talk about how personal growth works, okay? Hang with me. So what is the things I cannot change? Everything and everyone else. Simple. The courage to change the things I can, what is that? What are the things that I have the ability to change? Well, if everything and everyone else are the things that I cannot change, what's left? Me. That's it. Just me and my response to things. Things are going to happen to me. Things are going to come in. People are going to say shit. People are going to pop in and say, not this shit. Not this Dreamscape Jesus shit. And I have no control over that. I don't get to change that. All I get to change is how the energy with which I respond to it. How do I respond to it? That's the only thing I can hope to change. And the wisdom to know the difference, right? The wisdom to be able to move through the world, always recognizing the difference between me and everything and everyone else. And which energy am I trying to bring to people? Am I trying to bring an energy to them where I expect them to change to make me feel better? Or am I bringing an energy where I am changing the things in myself that I want to be better so I can better interact with them, okay? We got some parameters, we're defined. Let's go a little bit deeper. God grant me the serenity to, God, whatever, person, thing, universe, yeah, okay? Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Now, I think that the way that we tend to interpret this phrase is, there are bad things in the world and in the universe that we wish would change, that should change, our lives would be so much better if that person just wouldn't do that, or if people just weren't like this, that we can't change and we have to just accept those things. And I think that's how we interpret that phrase, is like, there's all this bad shit. There's all the climate change, war, famine, abuse, exploitation, coercion, manipulation, all the things we talked about before, that we wish were different and that we can't, that we have so little control over. Money woes, all this stuff. We wish we could change these things and we can't. And I think that's how we tend to view this phrase, is it's like stuff that should change, but that we have no power to change. And it does include that stuff, because sometimes there are things that people need to change. Sometimes you are in a situation where a person is being abusive to you, where a person is being manipulative with their language or with their body language to you, where bad stuff is happening and you wish it would change and you wish you had some kind of power to control it or to change it. And you need that serenity to let go of that and look inward on how you can, what you can do. Can you leave? Can you seek shelter or safety in some way? Can you do something to free yourself of that negative situation? So this does exist, this framework of like stuff that should change that I can't change. But the thing that I think gets left out of this with grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. I think we tend to end it there, that there's all this stuff that I wish would change, but I can't change it. But there's also things in our lives that we wish would change that are actually fine the way they are. They don't need to be changed. And what needs to be changed is us. Those things are fine the way that they are. We wish they would change because we think we'd feel better if they changed, but those things are actually fine. And there's nothing wrong with them. An example, you're on a plane and a six-year-old is watching a cartoon on an iPad and laughing really loudly behind you. And you're a little bit nervous and anxious on planes and you're kind of tired and you just want that fucking kid to shut up. Valid. And I get it. And maybe you're like, nah, that kid should change and stop being a friggin' annoying little kid. But like fundamentally, there's nothing wrong with that kid enjoying that cartoon and laughing. They don't need to change. They don't need to stop being a six-year-old so that you can have a better flight. You need to figure out what your approach to being in closed quarters in a confined space on an air pressurized tube in the air is going to be to make sure that you do what you need to do to have a comfortable flight. Because you can't control anyone else on this flight. Can't control them. And that kid who's laughing loudly and annoying you isn't actually doing anything wrong. They don't actually need to change. Maybe a more succinct and healthy and useful example. One that I'm sure you've experienced. I know I have. I think it's very common. I think it's universal. I think the experience of this is unavoidable, just like the experience of being annoyed at the kid laughing might be unavoidable. You might not be able to avoid the feeling of being annoyed, and that's okay, but you don't have to act from that feeling. If you act from that feeling and you turn around and you look at that kid's parents and you say, "Will you shut him up?" you're coming to the world with an expectation that the world should change to make you feel better, rather than you changing to make yourself feel better. And it's unreasonable to ask for the world to change. So this next example, I think, further solidifies that. Have you ever had a situation where someone in your life that you care about or that you're close to, or maybe even not, maybe like an enemy, maybe an old high school nemesis, gets something or has an experience that you see on social media or you learn about from a friend at lunch, and it makes you feel enormously jealous or resentful? Someone gets engaged. Someone that you have a crush on gets into a new relationship, and you feel jealous. You feel left behind. You feel like you lost somehow. Again, you can't avoid it. Jealousy is going to be there. You can't stop having that feeling. That's impossible. But what you might be able to do is feel that feeling. Acknowledge it, acknowledge that it's valid and that it's not something that you control. That's another thing you don't control. So in the grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, part of that is the feelings that come in, the stimulus that you are hit with. My friend keeps calling me and I'm like, "You're interrupting my live stream. Stop it." the feelings that emerge from certain stimuli, you don't control that. You don't control that. You can't control that. And that's okay. But you get to control your response to it. So an example of this right now that just happened in my life. A friend of mine, without naming names, recently started painting for the first time in his life. And he started painting like in his mid-40s, just randomly. And wouldn't you know it, lo and behold, he's kind of great at it. He's kind of brilliant at it. And I'm so proud of him. And his paintings are like really, really wonderful. And I mean, I'm even kind of jealous of them. I'm kind of like, geez, should I like go out and get some canvas and try painting? I mean, like, he just picked it up and he's pretty damn good at it. But I'm also like not surprised that he's good at it. I think one of this person's key talents is having an eye for aesthetic and detail and like how shape and color interplay with each other. He's always had a good eye for that. And I think that like it makes sense that he would be a good painter. But this person who randomly decided to start painting in his mid-40s has a sister who's been painting her entire adult life, who has 2 degrees in fine art. And upon seeing that her brother had sold a painting for $600 in his first couple months of being a painter, she made a remark to him, something to the effect of like, oh, wow, I guess I didn't need those 2 degrees or those 2 decades of practice. I guess I could have just farted out, you know, a masterpiece and sold it for several $100. She came to him in a spirit of jealousy, insecurity, fear, experiencing emotions that we've all experienced before that are understandable and relatable. Emotions that we all get and that we all know intimately. The problem is she came to him with an expectation that, like, there's something he's supposed to do to fix those feelings for her. And if you think about it, it's like, well, what is he supposed to do in that situation? What is he supposed to change to make her feel better? Is he supposed to not paint or paint worse? And both of those requests are unreasonable requests. There's actually nothing in this situation that he can do or should do to make her feel better. There is nothing that he needs to change to make her feel better. She's the one who has to change. So in this situation, she is lacking the wisdom to know the difference between the things that she cannot change and the things that she needs to change if she wants to grow. She's coming to her brother, expecting him to facilitate the change to make her feel better. When the actual solution is, she needs to acknowledge that feeling that she does not control, that feeling that she does not choose, that feeling that just emerges on its own, process that on her own, and find a way to come to her brother with support and love and say, I'm so thrilled that you found a new thing that makes you feel alive and that makes you feel boosted and excited about art in a way that shifts your perspective. And that's really like how she's going to grow, is to go through the pain, to go through the feeling of discomfort, the pain, the discomfort of the jealousy, of the insecurity, of the, and I've, dude, I did a movie several years back with this big famous actor. I won't say who it was, but I was talking to him at lunch and I said, so how'd you get into this industry? And he told me a story about how, like, when he was 7 years old, he was at school and a casting director came into his school and cast him in a Terrence Malick film with Brad Pitt and Jessica Chastain and Sean Penn. And I guess you can guess what movie it is and you can look it up on IMDb and see which child actor is in that movie and you can maybe put the pieces together if you want to. But this person told me that, and I'm a person who's been trying to be a successful, you know, living actor my entire life. And I started young. I started when I was like 8 or 9. And it just was given to this kid, just out of the blue. He didn't even necessarily want it. And then he told me, he said, I'm really starting to enjoy it. And he was about 22 at this point. And he said, I'm starting to really enjoy it. And boy, was I chuffed at that. That the universe had just bestowed on this person, this thing that I'd been working my entire life to get, this thing that I wanted more than anything else. And he was just learning that it's kind of fun and that he kind of likes it and that he kind of likes getting paid millions of dollars to live my dream. And I was annoyed by that. And I felt angry and I felt cheated by the universe. And, but again, what can he do to make me feel better in that situation? Is he supposed to quit acting? Is he supposed to give up a multi-million dollar career to make me? And will that fix me? And will that fix my career? And will that make me better? No, not at all. Not in the slightest. He can't do anything to make me feel better. And is he supposed to act worse and be a worse act? No, I'm the one who has to change. I'm the one who has to look at how the universe decided to dole out something in an uneven way, like it always does. And I have to take on the feeling of disappointment and the feeling of being cosmically robbed of something that I feel like I'm owed. And I have to sit with that discomfort. And then I have to be able to transfer it and go, well, I'm glad that guy got it. That's cool. And that's how I want to approach people when they get something that I want, when they have something that I want. I don't want to come to them saying, you need to not have that so I can feel better. I want to work through my discomfort and then come to them and say, I'm glad you have that and I'm happy for you. So on the lines of how do we grow? So that's sort of exploring and getting into the depths of the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Sometimes there are things that should change that you can't change, and sometimes there are things that don't need to change, that are fine as they are, and you just need to learn how to accept it and change your behavior and your reaction to it. Now, the courage to change the things I can. I want to explore this word courage. It's not the audacity to change the things I can. It's not the strength to change the things I can. It's not the patience to change the things I can. It's not the willingness to change the things I can. It's the courage. Courage is required for growth. Massive courage. Courage beyond, courage that makes most of us so existentially terrified. Lately in my life, many people who are close to me have been doing ayahuasca retreats and coming back and reporting the stories of their retreats to me. I've never done ayahuasca. I've experimented with LSD, with psilocybin, MDMA, all kinds of things. I've never done ayahuasca. I've been sober for 5 years. I haven't done any psychedelic drugs in that time. Well, for 4.5 years. But all these people close to me in my life have been coming back and telling me their story. And it's always just this monumental shift. It's this massive, huge spiritual experience that is a tectonic shift in their life. It's a massive moment of learning and instruction and growth. But the stories are also like remarkably similar every time. It's always the same story. And to anyone who's never done it, there are many elements of the story, and maybe you've heard someone report one of these stories, that are like nightmarishly terrifying. Like, it's like everyone's like, I gotta tell you about my ayahuasca retreat, man. It was so beautiful. It was so amazing. And you're like, oh yeah, tell me about it. I can't wait to hear about it. And you sit down and you get ready to hold the space for them. And you get ready to like, be like, oh, tell me all about it. And they start off and they're like, so I went up there and I'm just a ball of anxiety. I'm just so nervous. I don't know what's coming next. I'm so nervous the entire, like, as we're setting up. I feel so uncomfortable. Everything in my body's telling me to run. Already a person like me with panic disorder is like, uh-huh, like, okay. And then it gets really cool. And they're like, yeah, so then we sit down. And we're all in this, like, dark space where, like, we can't really see anything. And there's someone drumming a drum and kind of, like, humming something. And I'm like, all right, I don't know if this makes me feel any better. This kind of feels a little anxiety-inducing. Sure, keep going. What happens next? They're like, but then the shaman leading everything says, who would like to come up and have their first dose of the medicine? And you go up and you drink the medicine. And I'm like, yeah. And then things get really cool. And they're like, and then you get sicker than you've ever been in your life. You fall on the floor, writhing in pain, seizing. Your stomach feels worse than you've ever felt in your life. You feel like you are going to throw up so hard that your head is going to explode. You are holding a bucket between your legs and violently retching and just purging everything in your body. You collapse to the floor in a heap of sweat and chills. You're shaking and violently writhing on the floor, thinking, is this it? Is this the end? Am I going to die? You're just listening to this story, just like, when does it get good? When does the good part happen? Like, this is the worst thing I've ever heard. They're like, you barely managed to stand up and crawl to the bathroom. Now it's coming out the other end. You got diarrhea and you're projectile vomiting out of both ends. You're violently shaking. While all this is happening, you're launched into a black void where a voice is telling you that this might be the end, that you are at death's doorstep, that this is death. You are literally being confronted with all of your most extravagant, extraordinary fears, like the height of pain. Just like, what is the most pain you can imagine experiencing? We're going to give it to you. Physical pain, the pain of illness, the pain of feeling like your body is shutting down and dying. Existential pain, the pain of losing a sense of time and self and awareness and being literally at the door of the Grim Reaper, at the door of death. That fear, just the pain of living in that fear, just all of the worst nightmares you can possibly imagine manifest after you take this medicine, and you're also in a room where some guy is drumming and humming while all of this is happening. The universe is coming to you and saying, what do you want? Do you want to die or do you want to live? And saying, I don't really give a shit. It's kind of dragging you by the hair into this situation and going, I don't actually care what you do. You're free to die right now if you want. You can give up and die here, or you can live and I can teach you something. And all of this, you're like, you're going like, this is the worst thing I've ever heard. How are you? And then suddenly the story switches. They make the decision to accept the pain and to accept the turmoil and to accept the terror and to accept the nightmare and to live and to accept the instruction. And invariably, the experience transforms into a reward of knowledge and fulfillment and pleasure that is tenfold what the pain was. And that's really how the story goes every single time. That's an abridged version of the story, but that's the story. Worst thing you've ever heard, like worst thing you've ever heard of, worst thing you can imagine, being willing to go through the crucible of that, and on the other end of that, experiencing extreme pleasure and knowledge and, you know, growth. I'm not saying that everybody listening to this on the live streams, on Spotify, wherever you are, should go out and do an ayahuasca retreat. The ayahuasca retreat is more of a metaphor for how change and how growth occurs in your life, and how the reason why courage is required, because hearing these stories from my friends who have gone on these retreats, it does not make me feel brave about going and doing something like this on my own. It inspires great fear in me. And courage is the willingness to act in the face of fear. It is not the absence of fear. Courage is not a person who doesn't feel fear. Courage is a person who feels extreme fear, extraordinary fear, overwhelming fear, and steps into it willingly. So what is needed for the courage to change the things I can, myself, and my approach to the world, is the willingness to step into extraordinary pain and fear and discomfort. In whatever scenario it might be, it doesn't have to be an ayahuasca retreat. It could be a marriage that you know is falling apart and is not working anymore, and you require the courage to go through the painful process of divorce, the overwhelmingly, unimaginably painful process of the different conversations that are going to have to be had, and the divvying up of things and items and a life shared together. Being willing to go through the crucible of that pain and that discomfort, and the courage to trust, there is a lot of trust and faith involved in this, to trust that being willing to go through that pain and that discomfort will yield a process of learning and instruction and peace and growth and ecstasy and pleasure that is tenfold what the pain was. So there's a lot of faith here. There's a lot of faith, like the faith that I can withstand the pain, that I'm capable of taking it, that I can have the pain come and be okay, the courage to trust that I'll be okay and that I can stand that much pain, and the courage to trust that on the other side of that pain might be something really, really, really special. So that's the thought that I had while driving, was just that, like, that little prayer with whatever you call it, you don't need to call it a prayer, that saying, that phrase, kind of encapsulates how change and growth happen in our lives. The first step is understanding that nobody else can fix this for me. Nobody else in the world. You know, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of people talk about how, like, you can't do it alone. You can't overcome addiction alone. You can't overcome alcoholism alone. And in many ways, that's true. I've had so much help over the years from so many people. But really, all that's happening is I'm going to people who are giving me, who are relaying their experience to me and saying, well, here's how I felt and here's what I did and here's what the result was. But at the end of the day, at the very, very bottom of it, nobody else changing their behavior is going to fix my addiction. Nobody else changing their behavior is going to fix my alcoholism or get me free of it. At the end of all of that, I mean, I'm relying on and leaning on the kindness of strangers and leaning on people who are being of service to me. I'm leaning on these people. But at the end of the day, I've got to get up and go to those meetings. I've got to pick the phone up and make those phone calls. Nobody can do it for me but me. If I'm going to change, if I'm going to experience a psychic shift, if I'm going to experience real growth in my life, no one can do it for me but me. I'm the only person who can do it. So that's that first thing, is understanding that nobody else in the world changing their behavior is going to fix me. Whether that behavior is bad behavior that should change, or whether that behavior is perfectly normal behavior that I just have a negative response to because of my own insecurities. That's the first big thing. The second big thing is, okay, now that I know that, I gotta be fucking courageous. I gotta be brave enough to go through difficult circumstances and discomfort and step into the unknown and actually try to do the work to change myself. And that's hard. But that's all of it. That's it. That's it. And then as I interact with people, I want to know that I'm bringing a spirit of changing myself versus expecting them to change themselves and their behavior. And that's the third thing, the wisdom to know the difference. How am I interacting? Am I interacting expecting them to change, or interacting with the knowledge that I will change? That's it. That's my whole spiel. Okay? All right. Let's see what people are saying in the comments. So Rachel Mary over on YouTube is saying, these people are talking about different experiences that they've had with psychedelics. And she says, unfortunately, smoking DMT gives people a really jumbled and disarticulated version of that typically. But I have had friends describe abridged versions of that kind of accelerated growth with DMT. Yeah, and I've heard mixed stories with DMT as well. So DMT is another one of these substances that people take sometimes. DMT is the chemical that your brain emits while you're dying. So this is, you know, just like ayahuasca, where it can take people to sort of a vortex or a place where it's like, this is death's door. This is like it'll take you out of existence and take you to like the framework of the universe, or the box in which creation is born. DMT does something similar. But I've heard I think this is a great way to say it, jumbled and disarticulated, that it tends to be not as clear. And I think that maybe the experience that people are having too is like, there's not a structured framework or a leader to help you through. A lot of ayahuasca retreats that I hear about always have people who are sober there, and like shaman and people who are guides that are there to facilitate and help pull you through and help keep you safe and help you have the fullness of the experience that you need to have while staying relatively safe, even though kind of stepping out of safety is part of it. Whereas a lot of people will just sort of like get together with their friends and just like smoke DMT and see what happens. And I think that's a little bit different of an experience, you know? And I think that you could have a positive experience on DMT, but I've also heard that it can be an experience that, while you do experience some sort of selflessness, some sort of lifelessness, where you're outside of form and a knowledge of like being, and you're just sort of existing in a pure form, in that form of existence that like is just the essence of just being, and you're somewhere with like geometric shapes that are the source energy of the universe, it's sort of alarming in a way where it makes you feel very uncomfortable when you return to your physical body and feel very discombobulated, and you don't come back with necessarily clear imagery or messages. But I think it's attached to the same thing potentially. But I don't know. Yeah. Patrick says BRB, gotta drink a death potion. Yeah. It's so wild, right? That like, that's essentially what people are doing, is like, well, let me just, and I think it is just this confrontation with death anxiety. That's what it is. I think that it's people confronting the ultimate anxiety, the ultimate fear, and being willing to pass through that door. And I'll be completely honest with you, I don't know that I'm ready for that. I just got off the phone with somebody who just did their second round of ayahuasca, told me the whole experience. It went exactly how I told you. It was like the worst thing ever, and then it was great. And at the end of it, I said, wow, I'm so happy you had that experience. That's so beautiful. And they were like, you know, I know that you're sober, but I hope that maybe someday we can experience this together. And I was like, I don't even think that it's about sobriety, because I do think that it's medicine. I don't think that it's a drug. And I don't think that it's necessarily about jeopardizing my sobriety. I think I'm just scared. I think I'm just straight up old school scared. Just scared that, like, I'll be one of the people that's not okay. That, like, my heart won't be able to handle the intensity of it. I'm just scared. And that's why courage is required. Let's see what people are saying. Cephala Counselor over on TikTok says, the only one in control of your actions is you. Take responsibility and do better every day. Yeah. I said something today that, I don't know, maybe I heard this somewhere along my journey, but it came out of my mouth and I was like, did I just invent that? Did I just say that? And I probably not. The likelihood that I'm the first person to say this is very, very, very low, because it's such an obvious saying, but it came out of my mouth without, like, consciously quoting someone else. It just sort of arrived in the conversation. So I'm not claiming this quote, but I will say that, like, it came forth without any, like, conscious borrowing from someone else. And the phrase is, your response is your responsibility. Isn't that great? Isn't that clean and nice and crispy? Your response is your responsibility. So I'm gonna put that in a song. That's gonna be a song lyric that I'm gonna put in a song. 'Cause your response is your responsibility. And it's going to be like that. That's going to be the hook. I don't give a fuck what you're feeling right now. 'Cause your response is your responsibility. And then people will quote it as I said it, because it'll be in my song. I don't give a fuck what you're feeling right now. 'Cause your response is your responsibility, not mine. Not mine at the end of it. And not mine. And we're out. And we're on to the next verse. yeah. Patrick on YouTube says, yo, that's super crispy. And I agree. That's crispity crunchity right there. That's some alliteration goodness. Okay? I don't give a fuck what you're feeling right now, 'cause your response is your responsibility. Okay? All right. you got it? You understand? Everyone good? Great. You were all here for it. So if someone out there writes that song, you all saw it happen here. Give it some sick harmonies, says OK McKay on TikTok. What would the harmonies be to the melody that I just sung? That I just squeaked out? What would the harmonies be? I don't think those were notes. I think I managed to sing an entire phrase with no actual notes in it. And they were in different places. But I don't think any of them actually managed to land on a note. I don't think you're... I don't give a fuck what you're feeling right now. Oh, God, I'm so stupid. Austin, hi, it's Hannah. Yo, is this Hannah who I think it is? Is this Hannah? So somebody on TikTok just said, Austin, hi, it's Hannah. If this is Hannah, who I think it is, then it's really cool, because it's kind of like what we're talking about. It's exactly what we're talking. I need to know. Is it Hannah? Y'all, who I think it is? it's Hannah. Okay, cool. Hannah from New York, Hannah, I'm assuming. Hannah, Brooklyn, 2017-18, Hannah. That's who I think it is. So it's funny, we're talking about how, like in AA, people help you. You need people to give you, suggestions and to teach you how the steps work and to tell you what they did. But like at the end of the day, you got to do it. So here's a really fun thing. And Hannah's been on my podcast before too, but Hannah saved my life. So if this is who I think it is, in like 2018, I was texting Hannah because we had met on a dating app and I was like, hey, you should come over to my apartment. I got a bottle of wine. We can hang out. And she was like, oh, I don't drink. I'm sober. And at that point in my life, I was trying real hard to get sober. And I was like, oh yeah, how'd you do that? And she was like, oh, I go to meetings. And I was like, oh, cool. I'm trying to do that. Where can I go? And she sent me a link right away. She said, here, you can go here tomorrow night. I thought we were going to show up and go on a cutie little date. I thought we were going to go on a little cutie date to a meeting and she was going to help me get sober. And we were going to like fall in love from that. But no, she was too smart for that. And, what wound up happening is I showed up and it was a stag meeting with all guys because Hannah knew what she was doing. And she was like, nah, bro, I'm not dating you and I'm not gonna like hook up with you if you're trying to get sober. Like, you go do that and I'll help you out with that. And I'll like maybe meet up with you at some meetings, but like, you go do that. And we still pop in and say hi from time to time. It's been 4.5 years and I'm still rocking here. And I had to do it. I had to keep showing up. And I had to keep talking to my sponsor and I had to keep, you know, working the thing. But Hannah sent me that text and was smart enough to not get entangled and save my goddamn life, dude. And here she is. How cool is that, right? How cool is that? And the universe bringing her in as we're talking about all this stuff. Hannah, if you just got here, we're talking about like how to grow. And we use the framework of the serenity prayer and all that stuff of like, you know, accepting that you can't control anyone or anything else. And that the only thing that you can change is yourself, you know, all that stuff, personal responsibility. Yeah. Someone, Emrad350 on TikTok just said bamboozled into sobriety. Legit bamboozled, legit straight up, like cloak and daggered me, like legit, like, but I wanted it and she could tell. And I didn't know what I needed or how I needed to get it at that time, but she had been through it. So she knew how to deliver it and she did it the right way. And that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here 4.5 years later. So, you know, pretty dope. Patrick on YouTube is saying Hannah is a queen. I agree. Katie's saying Hannah has the wisdom to know the difference. That's what's up. Hannah has the wisdom to know the difference. Okay. Oh yeah, this is great. And Hannah says, wait, but tell them about your first meeting. Okay, I'll tell them about this too. So this is funny. So I get there and it's all dudes. And also I didn't know that it was AA and I didn't want AA because I was like, no God stuff. I don't want to pray. I don't want God stuff. So I just, I think I said maybe something to Hannah, like I'm looking for something secular. I'm looking for something. And she was like, yeah, just go here. So I was like, okay. So I didn't say it was AA. I show up and there's all these AA signs on the wall. And I'm like, ah, fuck. And I'm like, first of all, she sent me to an all guys meeting. Second of all, it's all this God stuff on the wall. Like, no. But I go and sit down because I'm like, well, I'm here and I'm giving it a shot. And the guy who was our leader that night, and first of all, at this meeting too, they make newcomers sit at a newcomer table and you have to share. So like everything about it, I just was like, oh my God, what is going on? But the guy who was the leader who shared starts telling his story. And he speaks for like, usually at one of these meetings, like the leader will speak for like 15 to 20 minutes and then they'll open up the floor for sharing for the rest of the meeting. And everyone else will share for like 2 to 3 minutes on what they heard and what they related to in the share. But the leader is like, he's like telling this story about how he was like a struggling songwriter and artist in New York. And he was like on the dating apps and he was just like sleeping around and living crazy and just going out till all hours every night, just like drinking, getting wild, spending all his money at the bar. It was very much my life. I very much related to every part of it. And then he straight up is like, anyway, I met this girl on a dating app who like told me that she was sober. And I was like, hey, we should go on a date to a meeting together. And she 12-stepped me. She sent me to a stag meeting. And he's saying this. And I start thinking I'm on candid camera. I'm like, no way, dude. I'm like looking around the room to see if everyone's looking at me. And I'm like, what's going on here? Like, did Hannah call this guy and say, hey, tell the story that like you, I was like, what's happening here? No way. I go up and I talk to that guy after the meeting. I'm a mess at my first meeting. Everyone is. I'm bawling my eyes out the whole meeting. People are tapping me on the shoulder, giving me pieces of paper with their number on it, saying, you're going to be okay. Don't worry. Give me a call. I go up to the guy who spoke at the end of the meeting and I'm like, hey man, like what you just told word for word my exact story, which I can't tell you how powerful full of a thing that is to hear someone else tell your story exactly when you thought you were sort of trapped in this like terminally unique narrative. And someone else is like, no, I've had your exact same story. I've been exactly where you are. He was also exactly 5 years older than me and exactly 5 years sober. So this guy was like exactly me in 5 years. He was like exactly who I wanted to be in 5 years. And everyone always says to find a good sponsor, find someone who has what you want and make them your sponsor. So this guy who spoke at my very first meeting, who had my exact same story, who was who I wanted to be in 5 years, who had all the things that I wanted to have in 5 years, I asked him to be my sponsor, and he still is today. And he's been with me for 5 years, because that was like February of 2018. It took me like 6 months to get sober. But yeah, so that's the extra part of that story. That's really fun. Happy Warrior says, whoa, wait, you're live? Yeah! MRAD350 says, was Hannah his girl too? I think so. I think Hannah's just out here on these dating apps, just 12-stepping dudes. Just 12-stepping. She's out there just doing the work, putting in that work on Hinge, putting in that work on Bumble, just 12-stepping them. She's out there getting it done. So, yeah. Someone says, hey, thanks for never shaving the mustache. You're welcome. Appreciate it. Let's see what we got. We might be done here for the podcast. I think we're good. We had a real nice conversation. We had a real lovely conversation. Katie Hoy says, this is amazing, Austin. I do absolutely resonate with your mention of the higher self in a video a while ago, and I think of it regularly. That has helped me a lot. I mean, that's my conception of like what it is that I pray to or meditate to. It's okay for you to have your own and whatever it is, whatever works for you. But that's like, I think that like God or higher power or energy or whatever it is a thing that's just in there, and you have the ability to tap into it. And sometimes you go days, weeks, months, years without talking to it and without touching base with it. And it can get kind of shut up and quiet, but like it's there and it's ready to be accessed at any time. And you can like consciously access it. In AA, they call it making conscious contact. So I don't really view God as like an anthropomorphized thing that's outside of me, like a personage that exists outside of me. I think it's in there. There's a version of me. There's a core of energy of like my existence and my consciousness that recognizes truth, that knows when I'm in love, that knows when I'm having a profound experience, you know? And that's it. That's higher self, you know? Puckman on YouTube says, I used to do the same on dating apps campaigning for Bernie. Yeah, just out there doing the right work, you know? Good. Happy for you. Yeah, all right. Yeah, we got some people out here on TikTok that seem to resonate with the higher self concept. That's cool. Right on. Hey, everybody. Thank you for such a lovely conversation. Thank you for being open. I covered a lot of ground on this one, so thank you for being open. TikTok, if you want to hang out a little while, I might stay on. I might need to message my friend back who was like calling me over and over again. I might need to message her back and be like, hey, I'm live streaming. Chill. But I'm going to wrap up the podcast here. As always, you can send me your feedback. If you listen to this episode and you got beef with my take on the adult industry or with my take on how to grow and how to improve, you can message me your feedback on Instagram, DM me there, or message me on Twitter, whatever works for you. But I appreciate the comments and the feedback in the thread. And like, yeah, I'm so happy Hannah showed up. That's dope. I didn't say this. Y'all, I was out of town. The reason why I didn't do a podcast is because I was directing a music video for Tiff Topol, who was here in the stream. Tiffany Topol was here tonight. I don't know if she still is, but she was here. She popped in and out, and I directed a music video for her. She's an amazing artist. If you haven't already, go to Spotify and listen to her album, Sophomore Effort. My favorite album of 2022. That's why I wanted to make the music video, and I'm so glad she let me make it. It was an incredible experience. The music video went so insanely well, and I can't wait for everyone to see it. It is like, it might be like my favorite thing I've ever made. It might just be. I'm really, really, really proud of it, and I think it's just because it was the right people saying yes, and you know, Tiffany saying yes. She's fantastic. So that was really exciting and a great way to start off 2023. I hope you're having a great start to your 2023. Let's wrap this bad boy up. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. Dude, we're getting the vinyl in. The vinyl's happening. I'm getting my test pressings next week. They're sending me my test pressings, and I listen to them, and if they're all good, then we get the vinyls, and you can buy the vinyls from me, finally, baby! And if you already bought one, I'm gonna be sending it out to you. It's gonna be good, dude. I'm so excited. AustinArcherMusic.bandcamp.com, Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music. Yo, 2023, and we still got people out there subbing to patreon.com/AustinArcher. What's up, dude? It's a whole new year, and we still got people out there subbing to patreon.com/AustinArcher. Y'all are unreal. So cool. So cool. Love you so much. Thank you so much for that. And everyone, I hope you have a great new year and continue having a great new year. We'll see you next week. Love you so much. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Bye-bye.